Hello, you. Welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And it's great to have you back, as I'm still not done with Tin Machine. And if you're listening to this podcast, neither are you. So it's good that for the next 45 minutes or so, we'll be enjoying a colourful behind-the-scenes insight into the making of the first and second Tin Machine albums with the man brave enough to produce both of them, Tim Palmer. Over a long and illustrious career, Tim has produced, mixed, co-written, or performed with artists ranging from the late great Ozzy Osbourne to U2, Pearl Jam to Robert Plant, The Mission to the Mighty Lemon Drops, and today he lives and works in Austin, Texas. And actually, yes, he did work with the band Texas too. In the first of this two-part conversation, Tim takes us back to his memorable first meeting with David Bowie in 1988, the surreal early sessions for Montreux, in Montreux rather, I should say, and all the way through to the final sessions for Tin Machine 1 in Nassau. I loved hearing his stories from the studio, but sadly, owing to some tech gremlins, my intended co-presenter on this episode, Leah Cardas, who was very much meant to be part of this conversation, couldn't connect. So while she's here in spirit, she is sadly not present on the recording. But some of my questions for Tim, the better ones, it has to be said, did come from her. Right, so onwards. And here I am with Tim Palmer in conversation about Life with the Lions, also known as Tin Machine.
I don't understand that at all. I mean, the record was made for a label called Victory, which was, I think it was a Japanese-based label financially. And I think all the paperwork is all caught up somewhere in Asia. And so I don't know, but nobody's either bothered or has been able to get the album back. But that makes no sense of how these people in Belgium or Holland did so. I don't know. But it is
weird because Victory was originally, I think it was a subsidiary of JVC. Uh-huh. And yes, it was Japanese. And then I believe it went bust around 94. So it wasn't around for a huge amount of time. But it is interesting to wonder how the ownership of those tapes, where that went to afterwards. Because, yeah, like Leah said, there hasn't been a huge amount of love for the Tin Machine project from the Bowie estate. You know, they haven't been included in any of the box sets. You know, the box sets have rather pointedly leapfrogged from Never Let Me Down straight into Buddha of Suburbia. Sorry, Black Tie White Noise.
Yeah, well, I guess in a way it's sort of fun in the sense that it's sort of like a lost album. I quite like that, but it's a shame that we can't listen to it. I have CDs of it, and I don't really have a CD player knocking around the house. So I just before we had this conversation, I played the album through on a YouTube compilation. That's nuts, right?
Lee and I had talked about it at Lent a few weeks ago. We also feel it's a bit of a lost classic. You know, there's stuff on there which is really good. I'm talking about Tin Machine 2 here. There's stuff on this record which is fantastic songwriting, and it tends all to be kind of brushed away under the general Tin Machine, you know, category, which people don't give an awful lot of time to.
Yeah, at the beginning, when the album was first released, the press response or to Tin Machine in general was good. They were quite happy to hear David going in a new direction and, you know, getting rid of that 80s persona. But it's strange. Yeah, it took a turn, didn't it? And it's not highly regarded, which is a shame because I think there's some really strong songwriting on there, and it's only tarnished because people didn't seem to accept the fact of it being a Tin Machine being a band with all members being equal, which clearly it wasn't. But there was no reason to not enjoy the music anymore, because I believe this, as you said, on that Tin Machine 2 album, especially songs like, you know, Baby Universal, obviously, You Belong in Rock and Roll, Amlapura. They're just really strong material. And if they'd been on any other David Bowie album, I think they would have been quite highly regarded. And in fact, it took him to re-record some of those songs for them to get some of the respect that they finally got.
Absolutely. Well, shall we start at the beginning then? So shall we start with kicking off? Now, I read somewhere that it was actually Billy Duffy that connected you with David to come on board with this project. So if you could just take us back there, then we'll begin at that point.
Sure. Well, obviously it was the late 80s. Around that time, I'd been working with a lot of guitar-driven bands, alternative bands in the UK, like the Mission. Do you remember the Mission?
Yes, Gothic, I do.
The House of Love. And even I did a band from Scotland called Texas, and even they were sort of guitar based as well. So I'd worked with a lot of guitar bands, and David had started to work with Reeves at that point, and they were basically sort of putting out the feelers to find an engineer that they could collaborate with, and what eventually turned out as a co-production with them. The word is that Billy Duffy did in fact put in a good word for me. I'd met Billy when he'd come down to see the Mission, because they were friends. The Cult and the Mission were in the same sort of genre of music. So I knew Billy from those sessions, and apparently he put in a good word for me. And yeah, you must have said something right, because not long after that, I was told by Isola, I had a phone call from David's manager, and it was that classic thing where David is about to call you. Are you going to be at this number for the next hour? Please wait, because he's going to give you a call. And I was completely shocked by this whole thing.
You'd had no indication that this was going to happen. This came totally out of the blue.
My manager had said that David Bowie's manager was going to call you about something. But then when the manager got on the phone, he said, okay, wait on the phone. You'll receive a phone call in the next half an hour. It was all this big build-up. And there it was. The phone rang and David was at the end of the line. And for me, this was incredibly, it was just a big moment. And I was quite nervous, I'll be honest.
Were you a big Bowie fan? Had he been someone who'd soundtracked your life to that point?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's why I was, nervous about the phone call. And he basically told me on that phone call that he was working on this new project, which, of course, there was no mention at all of any Tin Machine at this point. This comes much later in our conversation. But at this point, he's working on his next record, which was very exciting to me. And he said that he was in Switzerland, and he asked me a little bit about, whether I was familiar with his work. Obviously, I was. I told him that I'd been listening quite recently to Lodger album, which is one of my favorites. And he said, I remember him saying that was quite appropriate to the direction that he was going, which was quite surprising to me. He said that, would you be interested? In most situations when I was about to work with an artist, I would always insist on going through the demos, but when you're talking to an artist of David's level, I just immediately said yes. I wasn't going to ask him if I could listen to the demos first, because it was a bit of a dream to get to work with David. So he said, okay, well, why don't you fly in to Switzerland? Well, we're going to work at my house for a while, and then we're going to work in a studio called Mountain. And he told me the date, and at that moment, it was strange, because it was almost to me as if that date had been branded into my brain. I knew what day I was flying, and I immediately started getting nervous about the prospect. So a letter arrived a few days later with tickets and things like that. And this is the funny bit. So foolishly, I actually didn't look through the tickets particularly clearly. I just sort of had that date in my head and put them on the sideboard. And the day before I was due to fly to Switzerland, I get a phone call from the studio owner, a French guy. And he called me up quite irate saying, where were you? We were waiting for you at the airport. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, you were supposed to have gone on a flight this morning. And I looked at the ticket and the day had been moved back.
Oh my God.
The worst feeling, because I'm a very punctual person. I'll be the first there at the session. I like to get everything sorted out. And this was so unlike me. So the one time that I turn up late had to meet David Bowie. I said to the owner of the studio, look, is it possible to speak to David, please? And I spoke to him and I said, look, I don't know what to say. I'm so sorry. I didn't check my ticket. You told me that day and I just kept it in my head. And then he was absolutely fine with it and said, look, I only live around the corner. It's not a problem. We'll set up everything and we'll leave it and we'll see you tomorrow. So yeah, that was a great way to start my relationship with the project.
What a wonderful beginning that was.
Yeah.
At this stage, obviously, David had been through Tonight. He'd done the Glass Spider tour. He'd done Never Let Me Down. Did you get a sense from him just with that initial exchange that, he might be looking for a bit of a new direction? Or did you assume he was going to carry on doing in the similar vein to what he had been doing?
Well, we didn't talk too much in depth about that on the telephone call from the hint that listening to Lodger may be appropriate.
Right.
I know that David and Reeves, when I got there, I was talking to them and I started to get an understanding of what the project was going to be like. And they had both been listening to a lot of music like Sonic Youth and the Pixies and Glenn Branca, very much in that alternative guitar world. And that explained to me why maybe I was getting involved, because I'd been doing a lot of stuff like that. I think that looking back on it, as you said, Tonight, Never Let Me Down, which were extremely pop orientated, very 80s, very programmed, very precise records. I think David was probably tired of being an 80s pop star making music for the masses. It really wasn't the guy that he wanted to be. And I think he was ready to have a new skin and do something fun and be a bit more creative again, a bit more experimental, less polished, you know, not looking necessarily for commercial success, but at least to get the thrill of making an album that he felt proud of. So when I heard the music, they were rough sketches at that point, but I could tell that it wasn't going to sound like those albums, that's for sure.
So when you got there, he and Reeves had been just working on songs together. It was just initially it was the two of them. Were you there before the Sales Brothers showed up?
Yes, I was, and I was part of the continuation of some of the development of those early songs, and they did sound very different because they were just sketches, obviously, but they were very different to what we finally hear once the Sales Brothers and Kevin Armstrong got into the picture. I mean, I think it was the whole record was like a very cathartic thing for David. I mean, I think he was it definitely was a reaction to the 80s process. We weren't sitting around, you know, fancy studios and bringing in session players, and it was going to be a band thing. And once the decision was made, and it was an idea that David had because he'd worked with Hunt and Tony before with Iggy when he was producing Iggy, and he had seen Tony, I think, in LA, and Reeves and I were told that the rhythm section was arriving soon, and yeah, that's when everything changed very dramatically, put it that way.
Can you give me a sense of what the studio was like? Because people often talk about sessions in studios and so on, but sometimes it's nice to visualize what the room was like, what the actual space was like. And of course, what it was like for you to meet and first couple of days working with David, because obviously, you know, this is a big deal. It's David Bowie.
The early days were fairly relaxed. We were just working in a smaller room. I can't even remember. I think it was part of the main studio we recorded, but it was just the three of us just trying little ideas. But once we settled into the studio, which was Mountain Studios in Montreux, basically, the studio is built on the side of the casino. When I was told that we'd been working at Mountain Studios and we were in Switzerland, in my head, I had this idea of this insane control room, which had glass windows looking out onto ski slopes and, you know, a very high-tech experience, and it was going to be top-of-the-line everything. But it was anything but that. Mountain Studios, as I said, was a small room that was built at the side of the casino that had a wonderful old Neve console, I'll give you that, but it was tiny. I mean, it was very cramped. It had a small little room on the side where we had a kettle and we could go in and make cups of tea. And there wasn't a big recording area. What you did was you used the actual casino, which is obviously wasn't being used at that time. And it was all done through tie lines. So there was a lot of tie lines that led you down into the main casino. And there was black and white monitors above the console so I could see down into the casino, which was the recording area. And there was a couple of vocal booths on the side as well, which were very useful to use for Reeves and for Kevin's guitars. Basically, the truth was that getting the opportunity to record in a casino was quite unusual. And Hunt being such a big, powerful drummer, I figured, okay, well, we'll set him up in the middle of the room. And I climbed up the side and put microphones all the way around the top of the casino. So what you actually hear on songs like Heaven's in Here or Sacrifice Yourself, the big drum sound that would nowadays be created with a digital reverb or a digital room was actually the sound of that room.
Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm.
it worked incredibly well. We needed to push the sound more, so we actually rented, strangely enough, it's not something I've ever done since, but because it was such a big room, we wanted the drums to fill that room with sound so that it would reverberate. So we actually mic'd up and set a little PA up on the drum kit itself. So the sound was being pushed into the room by other speakers inside the room, as it were. And then I mic'd up there. So it was really fun. They were all set up together, but I only had visual contact through these monitors. And the guitars were inside the booths, and that kept the guitars from going into the casino and spoiling the reverb effect and getting out of control. So basically, the casino itself was the reverb on that was mainly used just for Hunt's drums. But it was a great setup. One of the things that we could do, which is a trick that's quite often used, well, it certainly was by me. But if you have a guitar player that wants to play extremely loud, like Reeves does, and actually can control the feedback of his instrument. I mean, Reeves can play the feedback once he gets a note ringing. If you're standing right in front of the amp, it takes your head off. So you can have the main amp in a room, mic'd up, but you can also split to a small, tiny little amplifier in the control room with you. So the guitar player can stand next to the small amplifier and get the feedback by moving close to the small little amp, which of course the feedback will then go straight to the main amp. And he can do all the controlling of the feedback from the control room at a level that is workable. So Reeves is in the control room able to do that. Hunt's in the main room. David's in the main room. And they're all screened off and stuff. But it was a crazy setup. And when we get to the next part where we move to Nassau, it's a whole different situation again. It was a challenge because the band, as soon as Hunt and Tony turned up, the atmosphere and the vibe on the sessions changed because they are big personalities. Hunt walked into the control room the first day and he had a t-shirt that said, "Fuck you, I'm from Texas," right? And that's sort of what Hunt is. He doesn't really take direction too well. And Hunt and Tony they're more like band members than they are session players. Of course, they can obviously play very well, but they just do their thing. And if you want Hunt and Tony, you get Hunt and Tony's thing. And there wasn't a lot of talking and sitting around discussing arrangements and fine-tuning and suggesting notes. It was more a case of, okay, let's do this. Let's get out there. And I know from being able to be part of those early sort of demos that we were doing, that the groove of these tracks changed dramatically. Once they had the idea of the song, it was, okay, everyone out, let's run this through. And that's fine. I like that. But the run-through often turned out to be the take that they wanted, which was very challenging for me because I had to try and get the sound dialed in. And sometimes I'm dialing in EQs and moving microphones, and they tell me that was the one. And you can actually sort of hear that, I think, sometimes on that first record. You can hear the chaos, but I like that. Once they had an idea in their head, you know, the song will change dramatically, even as they played it. Hunt had a thing where if he wasn't happy with his headphones and the way they sounded, quite often he would grab hold of the microphones mid-take and just move them down closer to his drums so that he could hear them clearly.
Both Reeves and Bowie talked about those first few days and indicated that it was quite a rocky process initially. Like you said, Hunt's a very confrontational character. He would have come in with, like, you know, fuck you, I'm from Texas. Tony also very much his own man. How did those early days go from your perspective? I mean, did they sit down, listen to what David and Reeves had got and say, right, let's go in the studio and do something? Or was it a more collaborative process?
Well, it was definitely collaborative, but they wouldn't, it wasn't a case of overthinking. That's what David wanted to stay away from. I don't think he really wanted to overthink anything. He's trying to get away from that 80s production value. So the whole idea of a band performance was what they were looking for. So once they had the actual basic chord shapes in their mind and a sort of rough direction, they would just go out there and start playing. It wasn't just Hunt and Tony, of course. We had Kevin Armstrong turned up. And Kevin was very important to have on board because Reeves, being such an experimental player, I mean, and an amazing improviser and an encyclopedic knowledge of guitars and sounds, he can tend to go off at a tangent. So you need something to hold it down. And Kevin Armstrong came into the picture because he'd worked with David on Dancing in the Street. He'd worked on Absolute Beginners. He played in Live Aid as the guitar player. He'd worked on the Blah, Blah, Blah with Iggy. So David and Kevin already had a relationship going. Mm-hmm. And Kevin's role was very important because he held down those songs rhythmically and chord-wise, which allowed Reeves to do his thing. And, you know, that's something that's often overlooked, but he's a very important part of that sound as well.
How far along in proceedings was it before Kevin got involved?
Kevin arrived around the same time as Hunt and Tony.
Right, okay.
And that's when the so-called band and the sound of the band really came into its fruition, really.
There's a very funny quote from Reeves where he's talking about getting to know the Sales Brothers. He's down in the studio, they're up in the control room, and they're continuously redirecting him. You know, they're saying, play like this, try this, do that, do that. And then in the end, he just loses it. And he just says, right, you know, I'm going to do my own thing. Did you feel that these guys were rubbing him up slightly the wrong way? He's had this very concentrated, focused time with David, and now, bam, here come the terrible twosome.
Yeah, there was definitely that. But the thing is that Hunt and Tony were sort of winding him up, really. That was the thing. They would love to say, no, don't do it like that, do it like this. And they would just push. And that's what Reeves would get frustrated by. But a lot of the time, particularly on that first album, there was very few overdubs anyway, so that didn't happen too often because most of it was captured within the take. But yeah, there was a lot of fun as well in there. I mean, they were jokers, the constant jokers, Hunt and Tony. We recorded that album actually on a Sony 1630, and that was not something that I chose to do. That was what the previous, when they'd started doing their sketches, that's the machine that was in Mountain Studios at that time. They'd been working a little bit with David, what was his name? David, the guy?
Richards.
Yes, Dave Richards.
Yeah.
They were working with Dave Richards, who I met for a day when I first arrived. He was a lovely man, and he showed me around the studio. And they'd been working on with that Canadian conceptual dance group called La La Human Steps. So they'd recorded some rearrangements of Look Back in Anger, actually. If you think of the sound of that record, it's sort of regarded as a big old analog sounding record, but it was actually digital. It sort of seems wrong to me.
Yeah, that's
a digital recording, and I wouldn't have chosen that. And I don't think Tin Machine 2 was digital. I'm pretty sure Tin Machine 2 was all analog, but the digital machine was very interesting. I mean, it captured everything that you gave it, that's for sure. I mean, that's why it's digital. You don't get any colorization from the tape, which is what's nice about tape, is it sort of compresses and brings out the harmonics a bit. The digital is very, very clean. But we had a lot of problems, and later in Compass Point, because the power on the island was so up and down, we had a lot of problems with dropouts, and it was a bit of a pain in the ass, to be honest.
Well, let's take a flight now to Compass Point. Firstly, why did Sessions move from Switzerland to Compass Point in Nassau? I think about 2 weeks in, wasn't it?
Well, let me get this cassette. You'll find this. Yes, so I've got my original cassette. At the end of each day, we would make a rough mix of what we'd done. when we were in the studio, and we had, I think, 21 songs recorded at the end of the sessions in
Switzerland
studios.
21, wow.
And David would take this cassette home every night, and as he drove in, he would listen through, and by the time we got to the end of the album, or the end of the session, because we had so many songs and he was enjoying it so much. I remember one day he came in really late and he said, sorry, I missed the exit. I was enjoying it. And he was just grooving out in his car, listening to the tape. But we made roughs of all those songs before we left. At that point, when the session was over, there was a conversation about where the band wanted to record. And I think Switzerland was a bit dull, to be honest. I think we used to get a bit bored in the evening. It was a really sleepy town. Hunt and Tony, I think, liked the idea of going somewhere with some sunshine and some seaside, really, essentially. So that's why we moved over to Nassau. And Compass Point was a studio that was originally owned by Island Records, Chris Blackwell. And we all stayed in sort of beach houses, which was great. You could walk to the ocean. And David stayed in Chris's house. Yeah, it was a very different setup. We were originally planning to go around the beginning of February 89. And at the time, my wife was pregnant with my first daughter. And I said to David, is there any way we could just delay by, you know, at least a week so I could maybe get a week at home before I disappear again? And he said, oh, don't worry, it's fine. You come when, as soon as you feel comfortable, which wasn't the answer I was really wanting. I was hoping it would wait, but of course, they promised won't start recording until you get there, but of course they couldn't resist. So they started to record. Our assistant and our engineer from Mountain, who came out with us, a guy called Justin Shirley Smith, and he took over while I was away for a week and recorded some drums. And I was really pissed off about it. He did a great job. I mean, he was a very capable engineer. So, and when I arrived, they'd already started to get into it. But it was a very different vibe. As I said, the studio was a very small, dead 70s type room, as opposed to obviously a casino. And there was another band who had been working there, who were in the studio when we arrived, and it was Status Quo. They'd arrived before us, and they'd nabbed most of the good gear, because there was a couple of rooms there, and a lot of the gear was floating. So they were able to, floating as I mean, you could take actually, wasn't actually floating. So they'd taken a lot of the good gear. Some of the songs that we recorded in the Mountain sessions actually ended up on the second Tin Machine album, like If There Was Something. Amazing's on the first album, right? Or is that on the second one? No, it's on the first.
On the first.
And Night Train, which is Under the God, was originally Night Train. We recorded the song as Night Train. When we got to Nassau, David had rewritten the lyrics, and when it came to the backing vocals, they were singing Night Train as opposed to Under the God, but we thought, oh, it sounds pretty good anyway, let's just leave it.
You can hear them saying Night Train.
There's another song on the album. I can't remember which one it was. And David, once again, had rewritten the lyrics, and we'd spent a long time on the backing vocals. And I said to David, look, the backing vocals are all wrong now. They're all singing the wrong words. And he said, it's fine. Don't worry about it. People will think we did it on purpose. Because he had a good sense of humor about this. And he knew the way he was perceived. He wasn't a fool. So, and people did like that aspect. But so we had Night Train there. We had a song called Pretty Pink Rose.
Oh, yes.
Now, that's cool. Look Back in Anger, of course. Video Crime. There's a song called Mellow Blue, which is sort of an acoustic song, which is great. And then there's a cover of All Tomorrow's Parties.
Really?
The Holy Spin is another great song. And I have all these, and it's crazy, because I would love to do something with them, but it's crazy. So, yeah, these cassettes are great, and I have DATs as well. I have a whole pile of DATs behind me, and I've got the multi-track, and I just hung on to all this. The other thing that was always fun was that David, particularly when we were in Mountain, he would have an idea for a lyric. And I know he's used this technique before, but he would have a newspaper or whatever. And it would be a chain of thought, a consciousness thing. And he would just sing stuff. and then think about it, and often would come back to that song with me, say, can we put this particular song up? And we would try and work out what he was actually saying, because even he couldn't remember. And we would sit around laughing about it. And sometimes he'd say, I think it might be this. And I'd say, well, no, I'm definitely hearing this. And he would say, well, I don't think it is, but that's pretty good. We'll use that. And then we would rewrite it up so he could have another go at the vocal. And it was great. It was really great.
Tim, you should have got a writing credit.
Yes, I should, really. That was the thing about David, was that I learned so much, because I was a young 26-year-old, you know, producer, engineer, and getting to work with one of my heroes. I learned so much from David. And one of the things that became very clear was that I worried too much about getting things perfect. And that's not the way a lot of the great recordings are. And sometimes something that's a mistake actually turns out to be one of the most important parts of a song. And a perfect example would be like the Gene Genie, when you're about to hit that first chorus, when the drum fill comes in, there's that build, they play like a strange length bar, and David ad-libs, get back to the Gene Genie, and it comes in, and it's in a weird spot. And that's the sort of thing that happens by mistake, and rather than go back and do it again, they turned it into something that was very memorable. And just keeping this sort of human element was very important, and something that I learned a lot from David on those sessions.
I was talking to Nicholas Pegg about the Tonight album, the recording of that. And one of the reasons that the relationship broke down between the original producer, Derek Bramble, and David was that Derek Bramble was quite, that was his way of working as well. You know, he drilled him pretty much to do take after take after take so that it would get absolutely perfect. And that was, I mean, that was in no way Derek Bramble's fault. It's just the way he made music. And it got to the point where Bowie became incredibly frustrated with this because, yes, you know, he had a far more looser, creative approach in the studio.
Yeah.
And welcomed those happy accidents.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that, I mean, it was something I was going to talk about later, but the unique approach, I think, that David had through his career was that when he surrounded himself by musicians or engineers or mixers or producers, rather than tell them how he wanted it to be, he allowed them to do what they thought instinctively was the right thing for those songs. And by doing that, he wouldn't tell Reeves what to play, and he wouldn't tell Kevin what to play, and he wouldn't tell me what microphone to use. And that allowed all the albums that he made to have their own unique sound. And that's really smart, really. He never imposed himself heavily, and he respected the people he worked with. And let's face it, once he sang on it, his distinctive voice held it together, and it was always a David Bowie project as soon as he opened his mouth. But the people that surrounded him, he put them so much at ease that he brought out the best in them, and he also made records that were very different. And I love that. That's the coolest thing.
Well, let's go back to the floating items.
Yeah, where were we? Yeah.
Status quo. Obviously, it's a very different setup here. So, like you were saying previously, you were in a cavernous casino on the mountainside. Now you were in a small 1970s-style studio in Nassau. How did that affect the dynamic within the band and the sessions as a whole?
Well, the dynamic was definitely more laid back. I mean, that's for sure. Just by being in the sunshine and the relaxed nature of it. And the dynamic of the studio was very different. As we said, sound had a much more claustrophobic thing compared to mountain, but it actually brought another dimension to the recordings, I think, because one of my favorite songs on the album was I Can't Read. And if you take a song like that that has such an uneasy, uncomfortable feeling about it, and then you put that in a small dead room so there's nothing that can, everything is right in your face, It just makes you feel uncomfortable. I love that. It's most definitely a claustrophobic vibe. And the thing about that song as well was that it was originally, I can't read shit anymore. So that wasn't fly at radio. So when he sings it, it sounds like he's singing, I can't reach it anymore.
I've never been sure. I was always wondering, is it I can't read shit or I can't reach it? I hear both.
Well, it is shit, but I mean, yeah, for the sake of the radio, he said that it was reach it. Can't stop it, which I thought was fantastic. It's fantastic. But the studio, yeah, as I said, was very different. The gear, we waited for gear to arrive, but of course it took a while to arrive because we were on an island. It was quite remote. And we wanted to keep moving. So with Hunt's drums, I remember I hung a few microphones with pieces of string from the ceiling, just held them in with a nail, tied a string on, and they would hang down over certain things, which actually worked quite well, necessity being the mother of all invention. But it was a lot of fun, and we'd eat dinner together every night. The lady who cooked dinner cooked a lot of conch, I don't know how you pronounce it, that shelled, you know. We'd have conch stew and conch everything. And we'd often see the members of Status Quo. Around the door, you could see them trying to listen in to see what we were doing. But they were great guys. We played a lot of pool and table tennis with those guys. And then at one point, when we were there, David decided and talked to the band, and he told me, look, I think what we'll do is we'll call this project Tin Machine. I remember being quite nonplussed by the idea, I must say, because I thought I was working on the next David Bowie record, and it turns out it wasn't going to be that way. I was obviously still really loving the opportunity, but it was a little bit disappointing to arrive in Nassau working on the next David Bowie record and then returning doing a Tin Machine record.
Wait, so all this time you'd been working with them, the thinking was this was going to be a Bowie album with these guys backing band.
It's like another evolution of another new, fresh thing that David was doing, but never the idea of, well, let's rebrand it as a band. That had not been considered.
Wow. Okay. That's really interesting. So that wasn't till Nassau that the whole democratic group, equal parts, band democracy, but David's really the leader kind of thing took shape.
Yeah, it was, as I said, I wasn't really particularly excited about it. But one thing that we did one night, which was great, was David said, look, why don't we go and play a surprise show? And I was thinking, how is that going to work? And he said, well, there's a club where they have a band that get up and play. We'll just go down and we'll borrow their equipment and we'll just go for it. So we thought, okay, this will be great. So there's a whole bunch of people in this club dancing to like a covers band. And suddenly the Sales Brothers walk on stage. And Reeve sets up and David's there. And he basically says, good evening. I would like to introduce you to my latest project. This is Tin Machine. And off they went. And wow. It was amazing. And it was in like a nightclub. There wasn't like a proper mixing board sort of 100 yards into the hall. There was a little mixer on the stage. So I had to get up onto the stage with the band. And I'm standing next to them trying to balance it. It was amazing. The crowd didn't know what the fuck was going on. They were playing Heavens in Here and, the crazy breaks, the blues breaks and the solos. I mean, it was really, really fun. And I asked Reeve's wife, his first wife, Sarah, to video the whole thing because I was really into around that period. You remember the original Video 8 cartridges for?
Yes.
I had a Video 8 camera when they first came out. So Sarah videoed the whole thing. As one performance on video.
So I had video.
And I also took a cassette of the sound from the board. And about 6 months ago, I synced it up. So I have the first four songs that they ever played together with decent quality audio as well. So that's another thing that maybe, I was really thinking that when there was talk at one point, I spoke to someone at a label and there was talk about, okay, there's the Bowie box set, and there would be a box set about Tin Machine. Mm. And we could have all these extra tracks, we could have video, we could have all these things, but
extraordinary. I mean, you've got that box set sitting right there.
Mm-hmm.
From the very first gig they did in Nassau to all the tracks in Montreux, and I'm guessing a lot more. Wow, that is amazing.
For my ego and for me personally, what I loved about the video that Sarah took of the first show was that because I'm on the stage with them, I can see David and me standing next to him mixing at the same time. So really special for me. It was a lot of fun in Nassau. Yeah, good times. Good times. And from there, we went to New York.
So the album was wrapped up at this point.
Yeah.
All the recording had been done, everything had been done. Just one last question about the sessions. And that is there one song or one particular track that you really contributed to in terms of you were involved with it from the get-go, that, you know, you made a lot of suggestions, amendments, any one track you feel particularly close to on that first album?
Well, not really. I wouldn't say that because, as I said, it was such a collaborative sort of vibe with the band and stuff like that. And I was sort of more working from an engineering and mixing standpoint. Mm. And obviously when the people are talking about parts and stuff like that, I would have my input and say, I think this one's better than that one. But no, as far as the particular song that I had more input, I wouldn't be able to think of that. No.
Okay.
I wouldn't be able to think of that. It was actually, strangely enough, on Tin Machine 2, which we will get to in a minute, but That album, I contributed a little bit, played a little bit of piano on and played some percussion on, and was more involved in because I was working with Reeves on my own, but we'll talk about that later.
That was Tim Palmer and I in conversation earlier this year. And please do stay tuned for the second instalment of this chat coming very soon, in which we talk about all things Tin Machine 2. Many thanks to Tim for his time and generosity in sharing his memories. Thanks to Leah for trying her best to connect. Sadly, it didn't work out this time. Also, thanks to Leah for this superb background music, which you're hearing right now. She made it especially for the podcast. And of course, thanks to you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed listening to Tim as much as I did talking to him. Take care and bye for now.